Hello and welcome to the Squawker Talker Euro 2020 Group D preview podcast. It is England time. Gareth Southgate's side are looking to go one better this time round after reaching the semi-finals of the World Cup in 2018. Huge amount of selection decisions for Southgate to make ahead of the tournament, with players banging form and some less so. I'm joined by chief writer right here at Squawker, Mohamed Butt, and I can feel the energy that he's got a huge amount to get off his chest about what Southgate will do and what Southgate probably won't do. So in terms of qualification, the usual setup, cruise through qualification, Nations League was a little bit sticky, but then the start to 2021 with the World Cup qualifiers, a very, very solid return, three straight wins. But as we all know, with England, when it comes to the major tournaments, that doesn't necessarily mean anything. So before we look at the squad and what Southgate's going to do in terms of certain key decisions, what is your mood in terms of positivity ahead of the tournament? It's a difficult group. Croatia, massive rivalry, obviously, with Scotland, and then Czech Republic completing the group. There's always massive pre-tournament optimism. How are you feeling England are going to fare?
Well, there's no gimmies in the group, right? That's the thing. Croatia is, and they're not what they were in the World Cup. I mean, that's a grudge match anyway, right? From the semi-final of the World Cup. They're not as good as they were, but they're still good. Modric is having an amazing season with Real Madrid. Rakitic is here and there. You know, Brozovic has been lights out with Inter. So the Inter Croatia are good. And then Czech Republic, they're a decent side. They're a decent side. They should not be discounted. And then Scotland is just a fierce rivalry game. Anything could happen. And, you know, with John McGinn on the pitch, who's going to be probably the best midfielder on the field, it's going to be very tricky. Scott McTominay is definitely just going to be trying to break some legs, although at the very least bruise some legs, right? So it'll be a contest. So there's no gimmies, but I'm cautiously optimistic. But the thing is, a lot of the optimism or lack of optimism is going to depend on who he picks, right? So the squad is going to be crucial, because England have stacked talent available to them, not so much in defence, but in attack and at right back. For some reason, stacked talent. It's just a matter of, is he going to pick the right guys? And then is he going to use them? In what way is he going to use them? And, you know, so we'll get into that now. And I mean, that's going to really decide my mood, you know? Like, is it like, okay, here we go. Or, here we go. We'll find out.
So Southgate, as you say, he's got a difficult job because there is certain areas of the team where he could pick four or five players to play one position. And then there's others where England are potentially going to be caught short. So we'll start at the beginning in goal. And for Southgate, this looks like a relatively straightforward choice in terms of his selection. Generally speaking, over the last 12, 18 months, it's been a combination of Jordan Pickford, Dean Henderson and Nick Pope. And we expect Pickford, who missed the World Cup qualifiers to injury, to come back in and be first choice. Generally speaking, the Everton stopper has been number one for Southgate, obviously going back to the 2018 World Cup. You don't really see any changes there. You'd expect Pickford to be starting in goal for that first group game.
It'll be baby arms. Yeah, it shouldn't be. It should be Nick Pope or Dean Henderson. Both of them have been better this season, but it'll be baby arms. And you know what? He's got great kicker. Great with his feet. Let's hope that comes useful. Let's just move on. There's no point debating it. He's not going to change his mind, is he?
Okay, it wouldn't be an England squad ahead of a tournament without a massive argument over a particular position. And as you said before, for some strange reason, this time round, that seems to be right back. England are absolutely blessed at right back with some of the options available. Kyle Walker, Trent Alexander-Arnold, Kieran Trippier, Reece James and Aaron Wan-Bissaka. So five names that could all feasibly start for England at right back. The likelihood is that Southgate is only going to pick two. Trent Alexander-Arnold at the moment seems to be the big name that is going to miss out. Southgate looks like he's edging towards sticking by Kyle Walker as first choice. And then that backup spot is probably a toss-up between the other four. But you're not convinced by Walker and you think that Southgate is being too conservative in his selections.
It's not that I'm not convinced by Walker. Walker's excellent. He's had an excellent end to the season. But if you look at the first two-thirds of the season, he was pretty rubbish or non-existent. Joao Cancelo pushed him out the side, right? He only really got in times because Joao Cancelo was playing left-back because Zinchenko was injured or whatever, right? Walker's come good the last 2 months. He's been very good. Fair play. But the exact same thing can be said of Trent Alexander-Arnold. And Trent Alexander-Arnold is one of the most, if not the most, talented and offensively minded right backs in the world. Like, he's such a unique player. Since the end of the last World Cup, so since the start of 2018-19, right, only one player in the Premier League has had more assists than Trent Alexander-Arnold. That's Kevin De Bruyne, right? Since this is three seasons now, actually, because of the delay. Three seasons of football. De Bruyne has more assists. Fair enough. Then that's it. Then it's Trent, and then it's Robertson. Trent has been so good offensively. It's ridiculous to not take him. And Wan-Bissaka, who's probably going to be the other guy to miss out, by the way, it'll probably be Wan-Bissaka and Trent, the two most unique skill sets in the team, in the squad available. You know, this amazing attacking player and this amazing defensive player. You know, Beckham at right, athletic Beckham at right back, and then the best 1v1 defender in the world. And you're not going to take either of them. You're going to take, okay, Walker's been good, but again, he's good. Trippier, who's been, okay, good, but he's a generic wing back. It's nothing too special there. Good crosses, but Trent's got good crosses. Reece James is a really good all-rounder. I would take Reece James because I think when you need an orthodox right back / right wing back, he's your guy. He does it all. Nothing's too flashy. Great crosser. Good shooting from range, actually. You know, so I like Reece James. I would take Reece James. I would not take Walker or Trippier because neither of them is necessarily going to be there at the World Cup in, a year's time now. And that's really what you want to build for. And Trent can do what Trippier does, but better. And Wan-Bissaka can do what Walker does, but better. And they're both younger, and they will both give you more upside for the future, and they will give you more dynamism in the squad right now. You could play a 3-5-2 and have Wan-Bissaka and Walker and Trent in the same team. Or Wan-Bissaka and James in the same team. Or James and Trent in the same team. Basically, you know, take the two most unique players you've got and then the best all-rounder that you've got and leave the two other guys who are more established. But you know what? He'll take Walker, he'll take Trippier, and he'll take James. And he'll start Walker, maybe start Trippier if he plays a back three, and then James will come on for like the third group game or something.
Is this the defender in Southgate coming out that obviously part of the narrative this season around Trent Alexander-Arnold is his defensive potential or arguable defensive shortcomings? We all remember the scene of Carragher getting down on his haunches and saying, this is what Trent Alexander-Arnold needs to do more of. Gareth Southgate, obviously, is a centre-back by trade. He looks at these situations and he sees everything that Trent Alexander-Arnold can do in the opposition's half of the pitch. But in a tournament, particularly in a strong group, as we mentioned, is he looking at Walker and likely to be Trippier based on the last two squads as better defenders? And ultimately, does that set the tone for how he's planning for this team, which is make sure we're nice and tight at the back, don't give away anything silly because there's no second chances, and then we look to build from there. Whereas a Trent Alexander-Arnold in the team immediately makes England more progressive.
It's, you know, it's minimisation of risk. And it's so strange that he's become this because in 2018, he was taking risks all the time. Like he played a midfield three of Jordan Henderson, who's a central midfielder, a defensive midfield, and then Dele Alli and Jesse Lingard, who are number 10s or wingers, attacking midfielders, forwards even, in central midfield. Like that was the most attacking and open like midfield you could imagine. And he took such a risk with that. And it was great. England were brilliant at the World Cup. You know, if Harry Kane hadn't gotten hurt, or if he'd swapped Kane out for Vardy or Rashford, they would have probably at least made the final, maybe even won it. You never know. So it's just, it's so baffling to me that he's now not taking any risks at all. Walker, and this is what I'm saying, Pickford over Henderson and over Pope is a safe bet. That's his guy. Walker over the other guys, that's his guy. He's 30 years old, 31 years old. Safe bet, you know, reliable. Southgate knows what he's going to get from him. Not exceptional, and capable of defensive errors. I mean, look at the World Cup. So, but it's his guy, and he's safe, and he's reliable. So Southgate's going to go with him, and that's sad. And that's going to permeate through the... I mean, I hope it doesn't permeate through the rest of the team, but I worry that it might do.
Looking across the back line, obviously the big story is Harry Maguire and the potential that he might not be fit in time. An ankle sprain suffered at Manchester United has ended his domestic season. There's still a chance that we might see him in the Europa League final, and then it's a race to be fit. And just like we said, it wouldn't be an England tournament without a battle for a certain position. It wouldn't be an England tournament without a major player getting injured a month before it starts.
Oh,
and this time it's Harry Maguire's turn. And without Maguire in that defence, you do worry for England's ability to keep clean sheets and shut out some of the better attacks in this tournament.
Yeah, you really do worry. That's the thing. And I mean, Gary Neville was on Monday Night Football saying this earlier, and everyone was like jumping down his throat about, oh, I think Maguire is more important than Harry Kane. And what he meant was, not that Maguire's better than Harry Kane, was that there's no one else that can do what Maguire does. Like, there are other good strikers in England. Maybe not as good as Harry Kane, but there are other good strikers in England. There's no one even close to Maguire in England. Stones has had a great season, but Stones had a great season next to Ruben Dias, right? Like, not next to anyone. Like, next to the football writers' player of the year. you know. So he needs to play next to a great defender, a vocal defender, someone that's talking all the time. That's Harry Maguire, right? Maguire and Stones, a great partnership. We saw it at the World Cup again, you know, in 2018. We saw that. Without Maguire, who's he playing next to? And that's the thing. It's so funny because, honestly, just go back like even 5 years, 10 years, England were replete with centre-backs. Loads of great centre-backs. Now it's like there's literally two, and even then one of them needs the other one. So there's one, really, effectively. Like, you know, Michael Keane has fallen off. Tyrone Mings has fallen off. Although he'd probably be the guy that gets the nod if Maguire can't go. But I think Maguire will go. Whether he'll play well or not is up for debate. I don't think he'll be fit, but he'll go. Connor Cody's very good in a back three. In a back two, not so much. Ben Godfrey is good, but unproven. It's not easy. I mean, that's why I think Maguire's going to go, regardless of how fit he is or isn't. He's going to go because there's no one else can do what he does. He'll be going, and I think John Stones is going. I think Mings and Michael Keane, maybe, or Mings and Eric Dyer, perhaps, will be the backups. I think that's all pretty terrible. Well, I take Mings because he's left-footed, but Dyer shouldn't be Dyer. I mean, you take Ben Godfrey, I think. That's the smart choice because he's had a decent season. He's young and he's very talented and he could be great for the future going forward. And if he's a backup, that's what you want from a backup, right? You don't want to take someone like Michael Keane who is, you know, isn't really good enough and would be passable if he comes in and plays, but you don't, you know, or Eric Dyer. Like, what is the point of taking Eric Dyer? Like, he's not a starter, never going to be a starter. He might come in and be a decent backup, but then if you're taking a backup to a tournament, you want them to get experience from it. And Dyer has already been at tournaments.
Looking at left back, similar to the goalkeeping situation, it looks relatively straightforward in terms of options of Ben Chilwell and Luke Shaw.
That's it, isn't it? This is the one area where I think this is the one area where no one's going to have any controversy. No one's going to complain. Luke Shaw's been the best left back best English left back in the Premier League. Ben Chilwell's been the next best. Those two go. They can play left. They can play in a back four. They can play in a back three. Or they can play wing back. You know, they're going to be great. Luke Shaw's redemption, arc from where he was, like just 2 years ago, but even a year ago, frankly, basically United signing Alex Telles sort of reminded Luke Shaw, oh my God, I'm actually good, aren't I? I should probably be good because now they've actually signed someone that can replace me in Alex Telles. And it's been the best 15 million United have spent because it's actually reminded Luke Shaw that, oh yeah, I'm a 30 million pound right back, left back even. I should probably, you know, sort that out. And he's been amazing this season. I think he was United's fans player of the year. Fully deserved. He's been excellent. He's been absolutely excellent. He's constant source of creativity. His crossing is there. He's improved his defensive problems. He's still sometimes a bit dodgy, but he's worked hard. He's good now. He's obviously a great athlete. And Chilwell, we know, is fantastic. Chilwell's potential is through the roof, but he's just been like outdone by Shaw. He's unlucky in many ways because, you know, he was actually done really well. And you think, okay, fine, he's in the Champions League final. But like, he's just been outdone by Shaw, who's just been next level. And I think that's really good for England.
Looking into midfield, there's obviously, again, certain names that are nailed on based on qualification and based on the World Cup qualifiers. Yeah. But the big question that Southgate faces really is how does he structure this midfield to get the best out of the creative players that he's going to pick? And he has three options, really. He plays a solo holding midfielder and backs someone in that kind of number six role with two pressing number eights ahead. He sticks with a flat three where everyone kind of dips in and out and does a little bit of the dirty work and tries to get forward to support the attack. Or he goes with what is worryingly, as we said, with the right back situation, a conservative tournament approach, which would be two defensively minded midfielders and then someone advanced, maybe not as far up as a number 10, but in an attacking midfield position. And based on what you said at right back and how you expect England to line up in that area, where do you think he's going to go with this? Do you think he's going to go with the cautious approach, don't get broken down through the middle of the pitch? Or when you look at the likes of Grealish, Phil Foden, etc., he will go a bit more front foot forward?
You know, again, this is the thing where England's talent kind of almost blows you away to a degree. Not necessarily central midfield, but the options. So, for example, right, he could pick Calvin Phillips as a lone number six, right, behind Mason Mount, great central midfielder, great box-to-box energy, and Jesse Lingard, right? That's a really potent attacking three that can play on the break. Lingard can carry the ball. Lingard can score. Mount can score. Mount can carry the ball. Mount can also hold midfield and get involved. Lingard works hard. Phillips is an excellent lone pivot, as we've seen with Leeds, right? Or he could play Declan Rice, Mason Mount as a double pivot. They're best mates. They've been friends since they were like five or whatever it is, right? They're both at Chelsea together. They love each other. They're great friends. They're excellent players. They're they're complementary to each other. They play well together. Their games mix, right? As a double pivot, and then you play Jack Grealish as number 10. So those are the two options for me that are the right options, the correct options, right? Because you're offensive, you're taking risks. Calvin Phillips is great. Calvin Phillips, Mason Mount, Jesse Lingard, or Jack Grealish, I guess. And then definitely, I think the one that really, really works is really pops for a tournament, gives you solidity and attacking flair is Rice, Mount, and then Jack Grealish. He will pick Declan Rice, Calvin Phillips, and Mason Mount as a number 10. He will play the safest, least risky 4-2-3-1 you can imagine, which, again, go back to 2018, and he's playing, I said the midfield he played in there was just most so risky. He will completely go 180 from that and play a very risk-averse midfield. Rice is very good. Calvin Phillips is very good. Mason Mount is very, very good. But again, when you play them all together, it's not... That's three players. That's two players you could play out of those three and get a decent harmonised midfield with a more attacking option. If Mount is your most attacking option in midfield and you're playing two holders, look at Chelsea. And Chelsea have Kante, who's the most vibrant player there is. But look at how Chelsea sometimes are so lifeless because it's hard for them to generate passing and create penetrative passing from the middle of the pitch, even with Kante, because they're playing two defensive midfielders and Mount as their more attacking midfielder. And, you know, you need to have someone a bit more creative in there. Jesse Lingard would carry the ball and be a bit more potent. Jack Grealish is a wizard. But, you know, so it's just, to me, it's obvious what he should do. And it's also obvious what he's going to do. Do you know what I mean? It's the same thing, same sort as the rest of the squad, really.
Looking at the attack, again, we know Southgate is a bit of a creature of habit in terms of who he selects. And it looks almost certain that it's going to be Harry Kane, Raheem Sterling plus one. Obviously, some of the names that you mentioned there that probably won't get into his midfield unit could potentially be shunted forward. And Phil Foden is someone that keeps popping up. And again, it's this misconception that he is a central midfielder, that he likes to play deep, etc. When you look at his average positions for City this season and where he started for City, he started on the left of an attacking three and he's been fantastic. And given the fact that he's got that partnership with Sterling, who would play on the other side of Kane, there's so many options that could take that last spot, which is probably going to be the number 11 shirt. Marcus Rashford, Jadon Sancho thrown into the mix as well. But Foden's performances and the fact that he does do something different and in Southgate's mind, in a less risky area of the pitch, he could be starting in that first game against Croatia.
I mean, Foden is the hot hand. That's the thing. Again, you know, you look back even just a year, 6 months, you wouldn't pick Foden to start for England. But he's come on so strong in the second half of the season in the Champions League that you kind of have to start him. He's the hot hand, right? He's absolutely outrageous right now. His dribbling, his runs from behind, his defensive work, his goal scoring. He's kind of everything right now. So he's definitely there. I'd say he's even the second name after Kane on the team sheet. Kane's first. Kane is Kane. You know, Man City's Harry Kane, Barcelona's Harry Kane, whichever one it turns out to be. Hopefully it gets sorted out before the tournament because you don't want him going through the tournament with that hanging over his head. No, you don't, though, because look at Spain, 2010, right? David Villa signed for Barcelona before the tournament. Went on and won the World Cup. If you drag that stuff out through the tournament, it nearly always impacts the player because they're thinking about it. Sort it out before the tournament, Spurs. Get it done. Just get it done. Sell him. Do whatever he wants to go, let him go. Free Harry Kane. Let my man go. But yes, Kane will start. Kane's the man. Special player. Very world-class forward. No question about it. He should start. The question is who goes with him. Foden, I think, again, the hot hand. You can't not play him right now, even if he's not objectively the best choice, which he isn't. But he's the hot hand. You play him. The third spot, like you said, I think Sterling is his guy. But the reasoning he's used to not pick Trent Alexander-Arnold definitely should not be starting Raheem Sterling. He's had a very, very subpar season. Especially the last few months, he's been really just bad, frankly. But his place in the City team is gone. He's lost it to Foden and to Riyad Mahrez. So Sterling, for me, should not start. Should go. He's good, but should not start. For me, it's Rashford or Sancho, depending on who you're playing. Basically, if you're playing a team that's going to sit back and just suck up your attacks, you start Jadon Sancho and you bring Marcus Rashford on. If you're playing a team that's going to give you a bit more, a better team, you start Marcus Rashford. Because Marcus Rashford, let me tell you something, right? There's not a more clutch forward in England. There is not. The teams he's scored against the most are Chelsea, Leicester and Liverpool with 5 goals each. And then there's Man City with 4 coming up next. Like, that's literally three of his 4 biggest possible opponents, or 3 of the biggest possible opponents. And they're teams he scored against the most. He's a big game player. He's a born big game player. Even though he's being taped up and held together with string right now and playing through pain, he's phenomenal. And that, so in a big game, he goes in, he has to start, absolutely, unquestionably. In the smaller games where you're playing teams that are going to just try and sit in and stop you, I think you want Sancho's guile to unlock them. If you're playing a big team, say a France or a Croatia in the first game or whatever, right? You want to start Rashford and Foden, right? Because you get pace in behind, you get runs in behind, and you get goals and you get pressing and you get all that sort of thing. If you're playing a team that's going to sit in, Czech Republic, Scotland, you want to bring in maybe Sancho and maybe Grealish in the front three.
Looking ahead to the squad being picked, and inevitably, even though it's now been expanded to 26, giving Southgate a bit more breathing space to add a few more names in,
yeah,
there are going to be big game players that will be left out. And as it stands, Trent Alexander-Arnold is the name that is constantly swirling around. Southgate could end up having a big regret over who he leaves out. Who are you concerned that is going to be Southgate's big regret? Before we move on to predictions, who is Southgate going to regret not calling up?
Trent, Wan-Bissaka, maybe Madison, because Madison, I think, gets you goals, but Madison also isn't fully fit. But Trent and Wan-Bissaka, it's like, you know, I'm repeating myself here, but those are the two guys. Those are the two most unique skill sets England have, the two most unique right backs probably in the world, or at least certainly in Europe. You know, this amazing, like, 6'2" David Beckham at right back. You know, and then the most efficient and dominant 1v1 defender in the world, like, why would you not take them? Like, if you're in the Euros, you're going to come up against someone like Portugal at some point, someone like France, someone like Germany. You're going to come against Kylian Mbappe, Leroy Sané, Bernardo Silva. You know, who's going to mark these guys? You know, you've got a guy literally, Wan-Bissaka, who has marked Kylian Mbappe and Neymar twice. So effectively that they ran away from him and to the other side of the pitch to try and do anything. Like Neymar's goals at Old Trafford when PSG beat Man United came in the middle of the pitch because he ran away from Wan-Bissaka because he couldn't get better of him. I don't know what more argument you need than this guy made Neymar run away.
Looking at the group, obviously Croatia, old foes from 2018, defeat in the semi-final there. Scotland, we've touched on in terms of the rivalry. Obviously, England are well fancied to go far in this tournament and potentially go all the way. It's not going to be easy. And if the knockout rounds don't pan out in Southgate's favour, it could get very, very sticky for him. Predictions are always difficult at this stage, but there's the possibility for getting Poland or Sweden if England win the group. But if they come second or come through as one of the best third places, they could get someone from the group of death. And that could be France, Germany, Portugal, Hungary if they spring a surprise from Group F. So based on all of that and based on how you're expecting Southgate to set up, where do you see this tournament going for England?
I think they'll win the group. I do think they'll have enough firepower to win the group. I think they can beat Scotland. They're better than Scotland. They should beat Scotland. They should beat Czech Republic. It's just a matter of Croatia. And I think they have enough to beat Croatia. I don't think Croatia are quite where they were before Mason Mount has a psychological edge over Luka Modric right now. I think they'll beat Croatia, or at least they'll draw. I think they'll do enough to win the group, right? So then it's Sweden or Poland. I mean, admittedly, Lewandowski could be a bit tricky to handle. There's no Zlatan, though. That will help if it's Sweden. I think they'll have enough to beat Sweden or Poland. I think they'll get through to quarterfinals. I don't know who they could play in the quarterfinals, but I think quarterfinals or semifinals is a safe bet because I think he's not going to take the risks needed to really unleash England's attacking players to win the tournament like he should do, but he won't. And I also don't think he'll commit enough to maybe, let's say, even just defending and playing on the break like France did when they won the World Cup, for instance. They didn't, or Portugal when they won the last Euros. They didn't really think we're going to try and play. They were just like, look, break us down. We're going to hit you on the break with our great attacking players. So, you know, if he did that, which again, I don't think he'll do that. I think he'll sort of go halfway. Do you know what I mean? Which is like, he won't fully attack. He won't fully defend. He'll just sort of be in the middle. And as a result, quarterfinals or semifinals. If he did either one of the other two, England have the talent to do it. And I think England could win, but he won't. He'll stay right in the middle because he doesn't take risks. And yeah, quarterfinals or semifinals.
Okay, slow and steady stuff from Southgate will probably lead to last eight, potentially last four. Mo, thanks so much for your time on this.
No worries.
Great stuff. And up next, we are previewing Croatia with Croatian journalist Alex Holiga. He's going to be telling us all about the 2018 World Cup finalists. We'll catch you in just a second. Hello and welcome back to the Squawker Talker Euro 2020 preview podcast. Group D is the focus and next up we are talking Croatia. I'm joined by Croatian football journalist Alex Holiga to preview their chances ahead of this summer's tournament. 2018 was a little bit of a source of disappointment, Alex, all the way to the final to eventually be seen off by France. But based on the squad that Croatia had then, Slatko Dalic has named his squad and there's not too many changes this time round. Experience is the focus. It was the focus 3 years ago and that is the case this time round. Is that the strongest way to go for this tournament? You look at some of the other squads, they've blooded younger players and look to maybe change things up a little bit. Dalic is relying on the experience and major big league talent that he has available to him.
Well, you know, Croatia doesn't really have that large pool of quality players. So basically, whoever is supposed to be here is here, you know. He has chosen to gradually rebuild the squad, not make any major changes, since a few of the players that participated in the World Cup have since retired. And Croatia do have some of the new younger players who are coming through and who are already playing important roles in the team, and some of the others are just starting to break into the team. So it's really a mixture of experience and some fresh young blood.
Qualification wasn't straightforward in Group E alongside Wales and Hungary. 5 wins from 8 games. Bit of a shock defeat to Hungary went down as the negative mark from the Croatian qualification campaign. That inconsistency then stretched into the Nations League in 2020. 5 defeats and 1 win from 6 games. Back-to-back defeats against France and Portugal. That steadied a little bit in 2021 with the start to the World Cup qualifying campaign. Obviously, that was a bit of a nightmare run at the back of 2020. But as we all know, within the context of COVID-19, results have been very, very strange and there's been a lot of variables at play. Are you confident that Dalic has steadied the ship ahead of the competition this summer?
I think a big tournament is always a changing point, and it doesn't matter all that much what happened previously in the qualifiers. For Croatia, it was strange to be participating in the Nations League in the top tier, because they are not used to playing the big teams so often, and they lacked in each of those games that they lacked some of the players, so they didn't get the results they wanted. They even looked humiliated in some of the games. But still, in the qualifiers, even though they didn't look that well either, they still qualified without too much trouble. And now I think the tournament will be an entire different story. It will all the players seem to be at their best level. Nobody is injured, and I think if they are going to have a good atmosphere in the locker room, if Dalic will be consistent in some of his ideas, they can be very dangerous again.
And obviously one of the big focuses in 2018 was that fantastic midfield. Luka Modric, Ivan Rakitic and Marcelo Brozovic, they were the fulcrum of the Croatia team that went all the way to the final. No Rakitic this time round. He's retired from international football. But Luka Modric is somebody that we have to focus on in this Croatia team. He comes into it on the back of a very long, very demanding season with Real Madrid. And so many times over the years, we've expected Luka Modric to be tired and start to feel his age. But he constantly is a bit of a Peter Pan character. He just brushes that off and goes again. Given the fact that he is coming, as I say, into the competition after a long season, physically and mentally demanding. Obviously, his contract situation is still to be resolved with Real Madrid. Are Croatia fans confident that he can give it one last push, given the fact that this is more than likely his last ever European Championships?
Yeah, people have been saying that about Modric for a long time now. He just doesn't seem to get too tired, especially when he plays for Croatia. He's still, you know, he still reigns supreme in Croatia's midfield. And although he has said that he's not made any decision about retiring internationally or as a player in general, I think he is he's in for the one last hurrah with Croatia at this tournament. I doubt that he will continue after that. Given all the things that happened during the season and his form right now, I think he can still be at his level at the tournament. I mean, he's not that old.
When you look at the rest of the midfield, as obviously Rakitic has stepped away from the international scene, Dalic has a decision to make in terms of personnel and the system that he wants to play. Chelsea's Mateo Kovacic is one option to come in as a direct replacement for Rakitic in the centre of the park. But there are other ways that he could play this. He could look to reshape the midfield. And someone that's really, really pushing his case to start in a number 10 role is Nikola Vlasic. At Everton, we didn't really see the best of him. Since he's moved away and he's joined CSKA Moscow, he's really, really kicked on. And he looks like he could be a star of this tournament.
Yeah, the World Cup was actually the first time that this midfield started to really function. For many years, the managers in Croatia have tried to, you know, to play both Rakitic and Modric in a complementary way as playmakers. And this was the first time it succeeded, and it was... A larger part of the reason for that was Marcelo Brozovic, you know, evolving as a player, starting to play more like a holding midfielder. So it kind of worked. But since the tournament, Croatia have switched in the way they play. Rakitic was absent from some of the games even before he retired. The first choice for Dalic is now again 4-2-3-1, with Vlasic playing as number 10 and Modric playing alongside Brozovic in defensive midfield. That should be his primary choice of formation. And even if Vlasic is unavailable, then they have Pašalić or Kramaric, who can also play a number 10 role. So it's right now it feels more natural to be playing than 4-3-3. But we'll see. Vlasic was definitely the hero of the qualifiers. I think he was the best Croatian player in the qualifiers. Even though Modric is always, you can never, you know, undermine his influence in any way. But Vlasic was there, scoring some key goals, assisting. You know, he just looks really well suited to the way this team wants to play.
And looking slightly further through the team in terms of attacking options, there is one big absentee from 2018. That front three of Ante Rebic, Ivan Perisic and Mario Mandzukic were such a brilliant link-up in terms of chemistry, the way that they were able to play. Perisic and Rebic provided the width. Mandzukic was a presence in the box that could get a goal. But obviously no Mandzukic this time round. Like Rakitic, he's stepped away from the international scene. So somebody else is going to have to step up. Andre Kramaric, who you've mentioned already, Bruno Petkovic, and Ante Budimir, who's having a really, really eye-catching season in Spain so far. That there are options there, but replacing Mandzukic, filling Mandzukic's hole in the team, is going to be a big job for whoever takes it up.
Yes, definitely. Kramaric is a wonderful player, but he doesn't really play as a striker at his club. And over time, he has evolved in such a way that he's much more useful as a second striker or a number 10. So it's kind of difficult to expect him to play a lone striker. Bruno Petkovic has been really, really good in the qualifiers, but he's a player who is... extremely inconsistent. At his best, he's the player that you think any team in the world would love to have, because he's not just a, you know, classic striker. He has the build of a classic number nine, but he's also possesses wonderful technique and vision of the game. And when he's at his best, he's just perfect for the team. Unfortunately, that doesn't always happen, and he has had his share of problems and drops in form. So we'll see what happens at the World Cup. While Budimir is more like a, I don't know, people might call him, you know, a poor man's Mandzukic. he's more like a classical striker, and he can be useful. But I think he would just be, you know, an option from the bench.
Obviously, Dalic, as we mentioned at the start, there are some young players that have been included that will give a bit of energy and a bit of X factor to this squad. But experience is something that he can call on. And when you look through the team and the names that we've mentioned, Brozovic, Modric, Kovacic, Rebic, Perisic, there's some huge stars there that other countries would be delighted to be able to call on. The fact that Dalic knows that so many of these players have been there and done it in major games for their clubs. Obviously, in 2018 in the World Cup, getting all the way to the final. How important is that big game experience going to be, particularly as Croatia will have plans to get out of the group and push on into the knockout stages?
Yes, this is something that has changed since, you know. When you get to the World Cup final, and especially if you are a small nation like Croatia, then, you know, everything changes. The fans' expectations, but also the dynamic within the team. They now know what they are capable of, what they already have achieved, and they know they can play the best team. So maybe they are not better than all of them, but they know they can beat them in certain circumstances. So I think the World Cup success has given them a massive confidence boost. And it could be both a good and a bad thing. We'll see how it works now.
And obviously looking at the games in terms of what is to come, England, a rematch against England from the 2018 World Cup final is a really exciting prospect for Croatia fans and for England fans. Scotland in the group as well will be looking to make an impact, having been so long away from a major tournament. The Czech Republic are a little bit of an unknown quantity. But Croatia will still be confident, as I say, of getting out of the group. And given the fact that if they can power through the group, potentially even top the group ahead of England, things could really open up for them to push on. How far do you think they can go? How far are you expecting Croatia to go this summer? Based on 2018 World Cup final, do you think they can match that this time round?
It is possible. It's not... I think realistically, they should get past the group stage. Quarterfinals are the... like should be the minimum of their achievement at this tournament. But if things go, you know, after that it's only one game, and it wouldn't be a massive surprise if they reach even the final. But I think the squad now has some different, more specific problems than the one at the World Cup. The defense is now weaker, and they have been really, really poor at defending set pieces. So these are the kind of things that could make a massive difference at a tournament like this. So I think they will get past the group stage, and after that, we'll see. We'll see, you know. It depends. I think there are at least five teams at this tournament who are better than Croatia, including England. But Croatia can beat any of those teams when they're at their best. Probably they can, I wouldn't bet on them ever beating France. But as for the others, they can beat them.
Great stuff. A little bit of cautious optimism from Alex there. I think we all hope that Luka Modric can have a brilliant swan song this summer if it is to be his last ever major international tournament. Alex, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Great stuff. And up next in the Group D podcast, we're going to be wrapping up with the Czech Republic. We'll catch you in just a second. Hello and welcome back to the Squawker Talker Euro 2020 Group D preview podcast. Next up is Scotland. The Tartan Army are back. They are back in business. 22/23 years of hurt are finally over for Scotland. And I'm joined by La Liga journalist and Scotland fan Ewan McTare to preview Scotland and what to expect from them from the tournament. But before we get into that, we've got to talk about two huge playoff nights. Most teams are lucky to get through one penalty shootout. Scotland got through not one, but two to qualify for Euro 2020. David Marshall, the hero against Serbia, saving from Alexander Mitrovic. And for anyone based in the UK, they'll remember this. But if you're not, the scenes during that penalty shootout were absolute madness because the lockdown restrictions meant that fans had to leave the pub and watch the penalties through the windows. But despite that, there was parties all over Scotland that night as Scotland finally got themselves back to a major tournament. Ewan, given the fact that it was so dramatic getting into the European Championships, what was that night like? David Marshall had to double-check himself to make sure the penalty counted. Did you?
Yeah, I did the same. I think everyone has their story of where they were, how that night went. And, you know, just like you're saying, it just shows you that most politicians aren't football fans, because when you're setting curfews and stuff in pandemics, You have to remember, games can go to extra time, games can go to penalties, and that's the most important part. So, yeah, those scenes of people peering through trying to watch the end of that game. I've been in Spain during the whole pandemic, so I was watching it from here. And interestingly, I watched that one with a couple of other Scottish friends, Scotland fans, and a Serbian friend and fan as well. So it got a little bit tense towards the end, and everyone had different reactions. When the save was made, one friend who will remain nameless got up and started just sort of punching my flat's walls out of sheer I don't really know what. I was a bit more like David Marshall. I've seen VAR intervene before. I was sort of also waiting for the referees to double check this, give the okay. And then someone else just sat there sort of in silence. And the Serbian girl was pretty unhappy too. So everyone reacted in different ways because no one knows how to react. It's been too long. It's been, 22 years since the tournament, now 23 years because, of course, it was postponed by a year, so nobody really knows how to react to qualifying for a tournament. Most people don't remember, at least my age, what the tournament was like. 98 was the other one. I was just a kid then. I remember we played Brazil in the opening game, and at the time I was a kid, I didn't realize how important it was and how long it would be before something like that happened again. So everybody's dealt with these 23 years of hurt differently, and everybody celebrated a bit differently when it finally happened.
And you'd be forgiven for thinking, looking at it after getting through two back-to-back 120 minutes of football, that when the penalties come round, and as you say, it's been so long, all the way back to France 98, you'd be forgiven for being a bit pessimistic and thinking, not again, Scotland are going to fall short again, something's going to happen. But right at the crucial moment, the players stepped up in the two penalty shootouts, all five takers scored, absolutely no mistakes. Obviously, we say Marshall the hero, saving from Mitrovic, but those signs are massively positive. When there's a real pressurised moment where, in fairness, in the past, Scotland have come up a bit short or they've found themselves on the wrong side of a bit of bad luck, that hasn't been the case this time round. This newer, braver, younger squad looks ready to take that step.
No, that's a good point. I mean, there's certainly a bit of resilience about this team, and, you know, when they're back against the wall, they can respond, and we've not seen that in the past. Over all these years of failed qualification campaigns, there's never really been, you know, too many last-minute sucker-punch moments. There was the Harry Kane equaliser in one of the games against England, but again, that wasn't a necessarily decisive game. Usually Scotland have been out of the running halfway through a qualifying campaign, so they never really get to that point where the hopes get raised. You know, all this time, they've only really been to one playoff for qualification. That was against the Netherlands. They won 1-0 in Glasgow and then got thumped from very early on, 6-0 in Amsterdam. So again, you never really got to the final moments of a decisive game with hope. The hope was taken away from you well before in the qualification campaign. But it was nice to see how they could come through, yet another game against Israel, even in the Nations League. That eventually is the path that Scotland got to the Euros through, because they didn't do it in their regular qualifying group. Even in the Nations League, some of the results they pulled out there, the 3-2 against Israel, were really important, really good. Resilience, I think, is just that word. And then, yeah, to go through two really tense games, come through extra time, penalties, all sorts of setbacks that happen when you're talking about 240 minutes of football. It's they come into the Euros with, I guess, a lot more confidence than maybe some of the teams who coasted in.
And looking at the squad and looking at some of the potential selection questions for Steve Clarke, something that's plagued the Scotland team for a little while has been this issue over how to fit Kieran Tierney and Andrew Robertson into the same team. And it seems like Steve Clarke has approached this the way he approaches a lot of decisions, with a bit of calm logic of saying you're better in one area of the pitch and you're better in the other. And he's essentially just looked at it. Kieran Tierney's far more comfortable on the left of a back three. Andy Robertson, we know that his best stuff is generally done in the opposition half of the pitch, where he can cause some real damage. We see that with Liverpool, who, despite the fact them not having the best season, he's still been fairly consistent for them. And this idea that it's a big conundrum for Clarke has probably been dispelled in the last 12 months. But having two players that are so important for their club sides and coming into the Euros in fairly good form, even if their teams are not, is a big, big plus for Scotland.
Yeah, absolutely. And when this issue it goes back years now, when this started to come up, I think the original solution on paper, at least, was, you know, like you say, Robertson as a left wing back, Tierney as as a left centre back, and that's what, you know, Scotland tried to do for a while, was to play it like that, and it didn't really work at first. But it's something that we've tried different solutions, moving one over to the right hand side. Eventually, Steve Clarke has just realised that this is the best solution, but you just need to work at it, and with a bit of patience, with a bit of consistency. And that's the thing, it was chopping and changing too much. Also, the fact that, you know, not both of them were called up to every Scotland squad over the years, whether through injury or other reasons. So the fact that they both had a run in the side, in these positions, getting used to playing with each other, getting used to playing with the rest of the team from these slightly unique positions compared to what they do for club level, they're getting used to it now. They know what they're doing. Robertson, I think, has grown as well into that sort of captain's role. He really has an influence on, you know, the defensive side of the game and the attacking side of the game from the left-hand side. And yeah, I think that's a big thing for Robertson as well, is just to be able to lead the team in the way that he needs to for Scotland, and do a slightly different role from what he does at Liverpool, where you do have other leaders. That's not his role here in Scotland. I think every time he comes to the camp, he knows that he's almost playing a different sport. It's a different game when he comes to Scotland. But now, having stuck at this with Steve Clarke for a while, they get used to this new back three formation.
David Marshall was obviously the hero in the playoffs, but the key man during qualification, both for Euro 2020 and now the start for 2022 World Cup, has been John McGinn. 5 goals in qualifying for the Euros and then 3 in the World Cup qualifying games this year. At Aston Villa, he's come back into the team, obviously a very nasty injury last year, and he just seems like the type of player that everybody likes. Aston Villa fans love him. He seems to be really liked and well-respected in that team. But he's got real quality as well. I watched an interview with him recently, and he's quite self-deprecating. He just talks about himself as being a bit of a grafter who puts himself around. But he's got a goal in him. He can pick a pass. He's got great energy to get around the park. And if Scotland are looking for a goal somewhere else through the team, a set piece or something from distance, he's likely to be the one to step up.
Yeah, absolutely. In Scotland, I'm a St Mirren fan, so I've loved John McGinn for a long, long time. I've loved him for forever. And he's that player who, like you say, was key in the qualification, but also has just been so good for Aston Villa that I think he's done a lot of things with Aston Villa that Scotland fans are just hoping he can do in a big game with Scotland as well. And he's done it a few times. Let's see if he does it in the tournament. Like you say, that shot from distance that he has could be a key thing, because, you know, Scotland, and I guess we'll get on to it, Scotland do struggle for goals sometimes. So sometimes you do need that long range one that, you know, everybody who looks at the XG numbers will tell you that's a stupid goal, but when John McGinn's reeling off in celebration, nobody will remember that. So maybe you do need one of those if you're going to have some success in a tournament. And I think not just the fact that he's a great footballer, but like you mentioned, this sort of his nature, his character as well, is a big part of who he is, what he is, why he's a leader in the squad. Every interview he does, he's upbeat, he's positive, but down to earth. And I think he's just excited as well. I saw another interview, he was talking about how all these years, which he's gone through, all these years of hurt, he's been, you know, watching the tournaments on, picking teams to support because Scotland were never in it. And he said he bought himself the sticker book for the tournament, and he's already filled it. And it's like, it's as if he's a 5-year-old kid. You know, he's that excited about being in the tournament that he's got the sticker book, and he's pulling off all the stickers and filling it up before the tournament starts.
Looking at who might play in midfield with him, Manchester United, Scott McTominay looks to be fairly likely to be his partner, maybe in a more deeper position alongside McGinn. But Billy Gilmore's an interesting option as well. We saw him break through with Chelsea last season. He looked really, really impressive at the back end of the campaign. He's struggled for minutes in 2020-21. He had an injury, and then Frank Lampard, the situation with him leaving the club / being sacked, meant that there was more upheaval. And generally, when there's upheaval at a club, younger players tend to be the ones that suffer. And Thomas Tuchel slowly brought him back into the fold. Obviously, they've got some massive games between now and the end of the season for him to get some more minutes under his belt. But the quality that we've seen from him already is enough to suggest that if he gets a chance on the big stage, he's definitely not going to be overawed by it.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And remember, of course, he'll be going to the Champions League final. I doubt he'll play, but, you know, that experience in itself is going away to Porto, going to a big UEFA event, that's already getting that sort of tournament feel, that sort of tournament experience, being able to work with someone like Tuchel. You have to have these players in the squad when you've got these players who have experience abroad, who know other leagues, who are playing in big UEFA competitions. that's valuable because not every Scotland player will get to experience that almost at all in their careers. So, yeah, Billy Gilmour has to be in the squad. Whether he starts, I mean, that's very doubtful. But, you know, as a player who can come on and even just contribute to the overall squad, that's a big thing. And, you know, like you say, Scott McTominay is another, you know, key player. If you look at the last year with Scotland, since basically the campaign to qualify, he's the player who's played the most. He's the only one over the last year who's played over 700 minutes for Steve Clarke. That's partly because he's always been available. It's partly because Steve Clarke trusts him. So I think he's, you know, a definite starter alongside McGinn, who's the second most minutes over the last year in midfield. With McTominay, I guess it's a bit of an issue of how exactly does he fit into that midfield, because the whole Scotland system is different to what he's used to at Manchester United. But then at the same time at Manchester United, he's also used to having to adapt because he's not always a regular starter there either. So to have a player like that who's got quality, who's at one of the other biggest clubs in the world, these are the kind of guys that bring some sort of X factor that maybe some of the players who are, you know, maybe in the Scottish League or further down in the Championship in England or the lower rungs of the Premier League, they just don't maybe have that big night, big game experience that Billy Gilmour and McTominay will have from playing Champions League and Europa League finals just before the tournament.
And obviously we talked about John McGinn and the goals that he can add. Looking at the situation ahead of the tournament, goals have been an issue. And Steve Clarke's made the decision to call up Che Adams. He's declared for Scotland. And given his form for Southampton this season, we know he can nick a goal. We know that either with or without Danny Ings next to him, he's still a threat and he's still someone that can be relied upon to score goals on a regular basis. And it'd actually be quite a strange situation to see him invited into the squad and then just progress and progress to be Scotland's likely starting number nine at the tournament. And I've got a side story on Che Adams, which nobody believes me, so I'm going to tell you this. I actually went to the same school as him in Leicester. So anyone that's saying this thing of his kind of last minute decision over his grandparents, I've met his granddad, and believe me, if he told you to play for Scotland, you'd play for Scotland. So yeah, that's Che Adams. But he looks like he's going to be the man leading the line. Given the fact that Ollie McBurney's had his injuries and Lyndon Dykes is a little bit unconvincing, can Che Adams be the man?
Yeah, I think he can be. And you know, that's what we saw in the last international break in March. It was for the start of World Cup qualifying. He was brought in, had been talked about for a while, was finally brought in, played in all three games. And the reports from behind the scenes that apparently he adapted perfectly to the camp. Everybody likes him. He fit in really well, and which he did well. He scored against the Faroe Islands, and people might shrug their shoulders. Okay, it's the Faroe Islands. You know, if Che Adams' granddad told you or me to score against the Faroe Islands, by what you're telling me, maybe we'd try really hard to do so, and we might manage. But it's not just the goal that he scored; it's the way he fit into the team, the way he played also against Austria and Israel. He looked like a good fit, and I mean, the way the Scotland system is built, the striker is quite isolated, whoever that is. So even if he doesn't have quite the chemistry with the rest of the players, like we've spoken about some of these players like Robertson and Tierney, who have built that chemistry playing side by side over these past few years, even if Che Adams doesn't have that chemistry with the rest of the team, he maybe doesn't need it because the striker is going to be isolated, whoever that is. So you sort of do need someone who can just get on with it on their own. And like you're saying, the fact he can also play that role at Southampton is a big thing. So maybe you just put him up front, let him get on with it and try and get him a bit of service and see what he can do.
Looking at the group, obviously, as much as it stings for a Scotland fan, England do look very strong. They're well fancied to go far in the tournament and potentially even go on and win it. Obviously, Croatia are coming into the back of this after being losing finalists in the 2018 World Cup. Is it a bit of a disservice to say Scotland are scrapping to get one of them best third place spots? Or do you think, based on what we've talked about, some of the players that are dotted around in this squad for Clarke, that they can go toe-to-toe? We know that the game against England, bit of an old cliche, but form will be thrown out of the window. Scotland will be trying everything to beat England that night. Is there a chance that they could get second place, or do you think this is a battle to get one of those third place spots and get into the knockouts?
Yeah, I think third place is probably the goal. And I guess to get third place, all you really need to do is win one of your games. You know, easier said than done, of course. But you basically have three chances to win a game, and that probably gets you into the next round. So I think it's maybe good as well for Scotland, the fact that the England game is the middle one as well. It's It's obviously the one that most people are talking about. It's on a Friday night as well. It's the one that everybody's making their plans for more than the other ones. But the fact it's in the middle maybe means it doesn't become too overarching and too much of a distraction in the group. It doesn't become the be-all and end-all. You've got the first one against Czech Republic, and I mean, if you go in and you manage to beat Czech Republic, which could happen, you're already maybe guaranteed qualification after one game. That's just the way the new tournament works with so many teams going through. And even if they lose the first one, even if they lose to England as well, you've still got that last wild card game against Croatia to try and go through. So, I mean, it's a difficult group with England. The focus is on that at Wembley, but also two games at Hampden, remember, against teams who, Croatia haven't maybe started World Cup qualifying as well as they've been in previous years. Their star man, Luka Modric, looks like he's going to arrive at the end of the season absolutely knackered. Czech Republic, you could beat them as well. So there's a good chance there for Scotland to pick up one win. And I guess with one win, you've got a shot of going through as a third-place team. And, I mean, that's all Scotland fans would dream of. No, I mean, we're being greedy now. We've got the tournament. Now we want to get to the next round. That's almost never happened either when we have actually made it there. So, the way the tournament's set up, it's still very much a possibility. We saw it last time with Portugal managing to go on and win the whole thing when going into the final game, it looked like they might be going out.
Great stuff, brilliant. I'm off to get my Panini sticker book and my Adams 19 Scotland shirt for the tournament. Ewan, thanks so much for your time.
No worries, pleasure.
Great stuff. And up next, we are previewing the Czech Republic as the final game in Group D. Catch you in a second. Hello and welcome back to the Squawker Talker Euro 2020 Group D preview podcast. And wrapping up Group D, we have the Czech Republic. And for the Czechs, it's a little bit of a case of deja vu in two of their old friends, England and Scotland, being placed in their group. I'm joined by Czech journalist Karel Hering to preview the Czech Republic and their chances in the competition. Obviously, old friends or old enemies, depending on how you look at it. England came up against Czech Republic in their qualifying for Euro 2020. One win apiece, so relatively positive for the Czechs. Scotland, slightly less positive in the Nations League. Does that familiarity with England and Scotland provide a little bit of an advantage? Is that something that will help the Czech Republic in their group games?
I would say it could be so. It could provide some small advantage for Czech Republic, especially against England, because when you play against such a big team, it's always useful when you have experience from some previous games. But what is definitely not a disadvantage from Czech point of view is that the national team played two away games in the group stage. Normally at Euros are big tournaments. You don't play twice against host teams. So this is definitely a disadvantage. And especially when we take in consideration the record of poor record of Czech national team when they play in UK against England, Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland or Ireland. If I made some statistics and I checked it and. National team won from 1990. They won only three games from 19 there. So the record is poor, and it can be really a disadvantage.
And in terms of the build-up for Euro 2020, obviously with the tournament being delayed, that means we have the Nations League and we have World Cup qualifiers at the start of 2021. 4 points from three games in the build-up in qualifying for the World Cup. So some of the positivity from getting out of the group in behind England in qualification, the Nations League that was then a bit more difficult. There is a bit of a sense, as you say, of inconsistency. Historically, there's a bit of inconsistency, but within the current team and the current squad, that has still continued and it's not ideal preparations for the competition this summer.
Yeah. You mentioned the inconsistency. It's correct. It's right point. If you look through the results of Czech national team, you can see every two wins in a row, there are one or two defeats. There is no longer bigger run of wins. But I would say, in general, the mood was. Very I would say very optimistic, but it changed after the game, after the defeat in Wales. Yeah. So because before that, Czech Republic won easily at Estonia and played very good game against Belgium at home. It was it finished by draw 1-1, and the performance was really good. So after that, it was quite big optimism among supporters, which is quite unusual because Czech people are in general are more pessimistic. Yeah? And usually when Czech team traveled to big tournaments, it's usually there is rather pessimism than optimism. So, but the defeat at in Wales, it changed a little bit. There are more doubts now.
In terms of the squad that could be picked and some of the big decisions to be made, there's a Premier League presence in the squad, and West Ham pair Vladimir Soufal and Thomas Souček have been fantastic for the Hammers this season in their push to qualify for the Champions League. Souček in particular has been really, really impressive since making his move permanent from Slavia Prague at the start of the campaign. And he's added goals to his game. He's very, very solid in that defensive pivot alongside Declan Rice, who he'll come up against, who will be more than likely starting for Gareth Southgate's England. But we've seen him in a defensive role for West Ham where he can score the occasional goal.
Mm-hmm.
For the Czech Republic, does he play in a slightly different position to get the best from him?
I would say he plays in very similar role for national team, because if you when he played for Slavia Prague, he was rated as a defensive midfielder, yeah, who was able to score many goals from set pieces, and he is very dangerous, as you know, as all supporters of West Ham know, he's very dangerous in penalty area in the aerial duels. But what was interesting when he moved to West Ham United, in first games he played higher than we used to be to see him. He started as a number 8. He played behind forward, and it was unusual for us because we know him as a typical central midfielder, rather deeper, or let's say he's kind of midfielder who can run from box to box. But what I want to say is that his role for national team is very similar to his current role in West Ham.
And obviously the subject of goals, Thomas Souček will be involved in that. You'd be hoping that he will be able to continue his goal-scoring form for West Ham this summer. But Patrick Schick is probably the most likely option if the Czech Republic are hunting for a goal late in a game. And given the fact that he showed so much promise in his early career, his time with Sampdoria seemed to really catapult him into the limelight. But since then, it's been a difficult time for him. It didn't really work out at Roma. Then a loan spell at Leipzig last season looked to get a bit more positivity in him. And at Bayer Leverkusen this season, he's not been prolific. 11 league goals is a relatively solid return. But given the fact that he had such a difficult time at Roma in terms of showing the best of himself, are you confident that he's ready for this tournament and that he can be a key man for the Czech Republic?
In terms of scoring goals, or if we compare all the forwards who are attackers who are available, he's definitely very important. He's the best one at the moment. And you rightly mentioned his problems in Roma when he struggled there. But on the other hand, it's fair to say to him that even though he had some difficult spells in his clubs, when he played for national team, he usually did very good job. He scored 10 goals in 24 games, which is not top, but it's not I would say it's not bad record. And that there was a problem for him because he between October 2019 and March 2021, he missed 10 consecutive games, so it affected him also. Yeah, but still, if you see him on the pitch, and his role for the national team is very, very important, and he should be the main goal threat for opponents.
Souček, ex-Sparta Prague. The Sparta Prague production line has continued for the Czech national team. And we've talked about Schick and the fact that he's the most likely goal source for the team this summer. But there is one other teenage superstar that looks ready potentially for a move away from Slavia Prague if his form continues. But as it stands, he's been super impressive for them this season.
Yeah, definitely. It's one of player to watch. Definitely. Adam Hložek is 18-year-old forward. He's at his age, he's already key man for Sparta Prague. He can play as a forward, he's a goal scorer, he can play as a winger, he likes also position a little bit behind forward, so like number 10. So it's very very useful for him, and he should be in the squad for the tournament. And he was a little bit unlucky because suffered injury in October or November and returned early in March, so he needed some time to get back to full shape. But now, at the moment, his form has been very, very promising, and he should be with the squad, as I said.
Looking at the Czech record in European Championships in recent years, group stage exit in 2008 and in 2016, but a quarterfinal finish in 2012, sorry, in Poland and Ukraine. And this is a difficult group: England, Croatia, semi-finalists and finalists in the 2018 World Cup. Scotland have had a very, very long road to get here, two big playoff wins, and they've not been in a major tournament since 1998. So where do you place the Czech Republic in terms of qualification from this group? Is it a battle with Scotland for a best third place spot, or do you think there is the potential for getting out of the group in place one or place two?
I think with the fact that with the new or with the format of 24 teams, when even third teams can promote from group stage, it's not as difficult as it used to be in past. So you can promote with 3 points. So I think the Czech hopes will be decided after the first two games. It means against Scotland and against Croatia. And I would say, I still think this team has ability to earn 4 points. Yeah. Maybe I can't say if it's 3 points against Scotland and one against Croatia or otherwise. I know about the qualities of Croatia, of Scotland, who play at home, so it's a very big advantage for them. On the other hand, you know, there can be a massive pressure or a Scotland team, big expectations. So you never know before the tournament. But as I see the team, I've seen all the games in the last 1 or 2 or 3 years, there are some good signs of positive evolution. Progress, and it's not old team. There are players. Most of the players are in their careers going up now at the moment. They are not off peak, maybe one or two, but most of the players are like Vladimir Sofa is a little bit older, but Tomáš Souček, Jakub Jankto are examples playing for good clubs in abroad, so having experience. But not at the top clubs, so they still have motivation to move higher in their careers. And also players from Slavia Prague or Adam Hložek from Sparta Prague, they also have a big motivation to move to make another step in their careers. So for me, this is one of the very important factor of this team for potential success.
Great stuff. England, Scotland fans, watch yourselves. The Czechs are positive ahead of Euro 2020. Karel, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much for interest and invitation. Thank you.
Brilliant stuff. And that completes our Euro 2020 Group D preview podcast. Up next is Group E, where we'll be looking at Spain, Sweden, Poland and Slovakia. Join us then.